Hey everyone, welcome to a special edition of the Dan and Joe Sports Show, breaking down the first weekend of NCAA March Madness action. As always, I'm Dan.
You know, Jeff.
All right, Joe, before we get into the men's, I want to give a special shout out to women's. This women's basketball tournament is actually, in my mind, in some ways more interesting than the men's tournament. Caitlin Clark just passed the all-time scoring record, I think, in a season for man or woman, and what was a really exciting game against West Virginia Monday night. And I feel like, not just her, but this LSU team, with of course Angel Reese and then Haley Van Leith and in company. I almost feel like now there's almost more stars that are really out there for, the casual basketball fan and women's basketball than men's.
Well, what it boils down to, I agree with that. And I think it has everything to do with the fact that you have the players that are stars in women's basketball playing 3 or 4 years, if not longer. And even though we've got the transfer portal era and you've had some players transfer, a lot of players are staying at the same school their entire career, like Caitlin Clark or Angel Reese or Paige Bueckers at Connecticut. And I think that that's just what we're missing at the men's level. I mean, every once in a while, we've got these outliers like a Zach Edey, for instance, but it's just not as commonplace anymore.
I think that's a good point, Joe. I mean, Paige Bueckers now, I think she said that she's going to return again next season. And I think that'll be her fifth year at UConn. The Iowa team's got some other players that have also been there for a long time. Gabby Marshall, who at this point, even though she plays with Caitlin Clark, has her own great basketball nickname, Gabby Marshall, for how good she plays in the time of March. And then there's I think Kalen Watson's the other one they have that's also been there for 5 years. So that Iowa team is also pretty star-studded. I mean, them and LSU, have, three household names each, which is something for women's basketball.
Oh, absolutely. And you've got the twins, last year, the Cavender twins, they're not even playing this year. One of them's going to come back next year and play her final season. So, you just got like a lot of household names in that sport.
Yeah, and then you have Juju over at USC, who's a really great scorer, and then the coaches now are making have such a great, personality. So because for the longest time it was just Gino Auriemma and of course the one that was at Tennessee for so long,
Pat Summitt.
Pat Summitt, yeah. But now, I mean, you look at LSU's coach, and then of course what we have with Dawn Staley. And I mean, it's just fascinating now, especially Kim Mulkey. She's one of the most fascinating ones there is. And I just love the attitude you have in women's basketball now. And I watched the game on Monday night with Caitlin Clark, and I mean, it was just incredible. And it was so close too, because I mean, it was interesting because West Virginia was so amped for the chance to get to take out Caitlin Clark in her last game that she ever gets to play at Iowa's Fieldhouse, and it really came down to it.
Yeah, no, it did. And I think that's a cool aspect of the women's tournament. The first couple of games are played at home. And then finally, I would also add that I think that the fact that you no longer have that UConn of the past that was just so dominant where nobody could beat them, or Tennessee, I feel like now you still have the powers that be, but there's more parity in that sport. And so you have parity reaches or meets the publicity of the star players, and I think that's the best place to be in.
Absolutely. I mean, even as good as South Carolina is, where they're undefeated, they were undefeated last year before Iowa took them out. So them being undefeated going into the tournament this year, they don't have that invincibility that you saw with UConn.
Right, exactly.
But, what's interesting to me, you were talking about those. I love how they do that in women's basketball, how I think it's the top 16 seeds get to play their first two games at home. And I just think about how much that would change the men's game and how much better it would be. And, that leads me into what happened with Auburn. You think about Auburn had to travel all the way out to Spokane, Washington to play their first game after winning the SEC tournament, having this incredible fan support at home the whole season, in Nashville when they won the SEC tournament. And they have to go out and play in Spokane, where it's just a difficult trip for Auburn fans to make. And I'm not excusing the loss when it comes to that, but that certainly is a huge factor to it. And you think about if they could have hosted a team like Yale at Neville Arena as one of the top 16 seeds, they probably win that game by 40 points.
Well, I think that, in a vacuum, there's a lot of things that can factor into an NCAA tournament. And I think that the travel aspect is something that people just never really talk about. And I heard Charles Barkley make the point before the tournament. He's like, how did Auburn stay on the four line as a seed after winning the SEC tournament? I mean, to me, it's inexplicable. And I did not understand for the life of me when I watched the selection show why none of the pundits on that show, the analysts, said anything to criticize the committee's decision to put them as a four seed in the UConn region, as we talked about. To me, that was one of the most baffling decisions, as we discussed last week, of the entire tournament, and nobody really emphasized it. And so, like, I think that that is something that just cannot be ignored. But like you said, it doesn't excuse the loss. But at the end of the day, there were a lot of factors that, Auburn's coming off the wave of the momentum from the SEC tournament, but having to go to Spokane and get a bad seed, I think that definitely played a little bit of a psychological travel factor where, the players are excited, but they're also a little bit disgruntled, if that makes sense.
I feel like, yeah, there was being disgruntled, there was getting the weak seed, there was the travel, there was, I think, to be honest, they said they were taking their opponent seriously. They didn't. I mean, you could tell they didn't. And I think a lot of it, you even saw in the beginning of the game, there was the frustration that they had after having such a great accomplishment, playing so great at the end of the season, dominating the SEC tournament, and frankly, in every win they had, dominating the opponent that they played. And then they take on this Yale team that beats Brown, who I think is like a 13-17 basketball team, on the last second lay-in to even make the tournament. And Auburn gets out to this huge lead to begin the game. And then Chad Baker-Mazzara, who I'll probably say is their third best player, gets ejected for that flagrant two elbow to the side of the Yale player. And after that happened, it just seemed like Auburn lost all of its momentum and wasn't playing clean basketball anymore. I mean, there was a time later in the game they got up by 10 points and then they turned the ball over four times in a row. And Joe, I don't know how I feel about that call. I understand that it was definitely a flagrant one, no matter what. Flagrant two is debatable, but I kind of felt like that was one of those ones where I'm not going to criticize the official for the call because I think that, you look under the rules, that's a possibility that you could make that call. It's a judgment one. But I just felt like that was so early to throw somebody out of a game for something that I think you could have arguably had as a flagrant one.
Yeah, I don't really like the flagrant two call in general. I kind of just wish there was just a generalized flagrant foul where you're not going to be ejected. Maybe ejected. Maybe if you get two of them, you're ejected. But
I think
one,
that's,
I just
yeah.
feel it's so subjective. And like you said, so early in that game. So yeah, I don't like the officials impacting the game that much. And like you said, Yale barely sneaked by the Ivy League title game. They were down by like 6 points against that Brown team and needed that last second shot. They were down by 6 points with like 25 seconds to go. And so, it made sense to send them across country. It didn't make sense to send Auburn there. And so just a lot of weird factors about that game. But, you talked about it on the show, I think before, that these Ivy League teams, the only way they're going to win games like this when they're overmatched is if they get hot from outside and if they make free throws down the stretch. And that's kind of what we saw Yale do to win that game.
That's exactly what it was. I mean, the things that cost Auburn the game, losing their third best player, and then free throws. Free throws was the biggest thing, turnovers and free throws. And so Yale played better fundamental basketball than Auburn. They weren't turning the ball over. And at the end of the game, I think Yale made 10 out of 11 of their free throws in the last 10 minutes. And Auburn, meanwhile, was 2 for 7, including missing the front end of 2 1-and-1s, which that's like missing two free throws.
Yeah, and you saw some of those Yale players, they stepped up there, even some of the guys that their percentage on the season was maybe like just north of 70%. They were making both free throws. So they played a little bit, above the percentages at those key moments.
Yeah, and I feel like every year, in the tournament, Bruce Pearl's teams failed to make free throws. And it's something that has just really bothered me as an Auburn fan, because in every other respect, he's just an incredible basketball coach. But I feel like his teams are always bad at free throws when it matters. And I don't know if it's a lack of focus on that specific thing, if it's just something that happens to his players, but I feel like that's the next step that Bruce Pearl has to take as a coach, or he's never going to win a national championship.
Oh no, that yeah, that's absolutely paramount to win a national title, because there's going to be games where, unless you're UConn just winning, games dominantly in a historic fashion, and you've got to be able to make your free throws. And even them this year, at some point that's going to catch up to them if they're not able to shoot free throws. And so yeah, that's like the great equalizer. Everybody's got to be able to do that in crunch time. This tournament's too chaotic otherwise.
No, I mean, even the year where Auburn made the Final Four, their best free throw shooter, Jared Harper, missed one of those three free throws, and that's what gave Kyle Guy the chance to make three free throws in a row on the questionable foul call to beat Auburn. And so, I mean, he needs to do something to really test these guys in crunch times to make free throws, because it just keeps happening over and over again. And the one that really cost Auburn in this one was Trey Donaldson. He has an easy layup. He doesn't make it, but he gets fouled and he misses the front end of a 1-1 when Auburn was down by two. They could have tied it up. And what really was the most upsetting part of it was Johnny Broome just made incredible rebounds, two in a row, to give Auburn a chance. And he got hurt on both of them. And they couldn't make a free throw and couldn't make a shot, and made it to where his efforts were completely in vain.
Yeah, they had some opportunities there for sure. And the last thing I'll say about the lack of free throw shooting, the equivalency is, in football, it's like not having a running game to be able to run the clock out, or in baseball, it's like playing without a good bullpen. Like that kind of thing catches up to you when you just can't put the other team away.
It does. And I mean, Auburn played in very few close games this year. They had two, or they had three of them. They lost every single one. And this one they lost because of free throwing the Alabama game. I know that Chad Baker-Mazzara missed two free throws at the end of that game to cost Auburn with a chance to tie it up. So it was something that was always there. It's just it didn't come up very much. And unfortunately, it came up here where, now there's memes everywhere where, and then videos. One of my favorite ones was they did the speech from Revenge of the Nerds that John Goodman does as the coach of like all the jocks, where, basically you got your A's handed to you by a bunch of nerds. And I mean, that's what happened to Auburn. They got beat by Ivy League school. And this happened in baseball too, where they were hosting a regional against Penn, and that was embarrassing. But not to this level. I mean, in my mind, as an Auburn fan, this is the most embarrassing loss in the history of Auburn sports.
No, it's definitely a tough one. I mean, you felt like, this is a team that had a great chance to make it to the Final Four, contend for the title. But like I said, it can't be understated enough that I just can't be more critical of the committee putting, in my opinion, four Final Four worthy teams in Iowa State, Illinois, Auburn, and UConn in the same region. Just absolutely despicable.
Yeah, it was, and it ruined what could have been, like you said, four Final Four teams. And UConn frankly deserved better than that, and it really was just a snafu on all sides by the committee to do that.
Yes.
And Joe, speaking of snafus, Kentucky yet again going out in early March. I feel like Calipari and Bruce Pearl are kind of joined at the hip in what they've done in the last couple years in the NCAA tournament. Since 2019, really, because 2019, Auburn makes the Final Four, beats Kentucky to go to the Elite Eight, beats Kentucky in the Elite Eight game. And since then, they've both been atrocious in the tournament. Bruce Pearl's been 2-3 in the tournament. And I think Calipari's only won one game since then, including getting upset by St. Peter's and getting upset now by Oakland. And, the St. Peter's story, at least with that, like St. Peter's made it all the way to the Elite Eight. This Oakland team just about made it to the Sweet 16. Really exciting brand of basketball. Really great story with what Kolke was able to do with his 10 threes. And then, of course, they had their player whose dad also played for that same Oakland coach who had been there for 40 years. And that's all well and good. And it was enjoyable to watch. But Calipari is really just, his teams are just falling apart in the NCAA tournament lately.
Yeah, that's kind of the way to sum it up. You had like an awesome story against Oakland and Golkey. That was one of the most enjoyable shooting performances I've ever seen. But at the same time, this was an Oakland team that, what, I think they had like 13 or 14 losses, no, like 12 losses on the season. I mean, this wasn't like, they were facing a mid-major that came in there with a record like Grand Canyon or, McNeese State. This is a team that had a lot of losses during the regular season. And, you look back at Kentucky this year, and maybe the writing was on the wall a little bit with, losses like against UNC Wilmington. But still, I mean, who would have expected this? I mean, you've got a roster that has a number of, as usual, talented one-and-done players like Rob Dillingham, like Reed Shepherd. You had some seniors on this team that are really good that had been there. You had depth on this team. But there's something weird going on with Kentucky right now, Dan. It's just, I don't know if it's just being a different era in college basketball that's kind of caught up to Calipari, or maybe just everybody kind of has the one and dones. But I heard somebody say something interesting recently about it, said that a weird thing about some of Calipari's teams is not only do you see underachievement now in the NCAA tournament, but you also see a lot of players from Kentucky who are becoming better versions of themselves in the NBA don't even make a big impact to Kentucky. Like right now, you've got players like Devin Booker, that's like a superstar in the NBA, barely could be a starter in Kentucky. In Kentucky, you got Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, like just through the roof in the NBA, more of an afterthought at Kentucky. You're not as, star laden. And so it seems like some of these guys are not necessarily reaching their potential in college with him.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely seems to be the case with Calipari right now. And, it's interesting, like, what do you do if you're Kentucky? Because he's won a national championship. It's consistent every single year. There is no other coach in the SEC who's accomplished what John Calipari has, but yet he's not satisfying his fan base. And it's interesting to me because, I wish I had John Calipari at Auburn. If I like as good as Bruce Pearl has been, he's not even accomplished near what John Calipari is. But you wonder, like, does Calipari want to finish his career here with basically getting questioned about what he's done over and over again when he has achieved so much? I'm just not sure.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what he does. I think it's kind of like year to year now. He's going to, go back next year. But honestly, that wouldn't be a bad trade. Maybe they should just, switch places like Freaky Friday. It might work out better for both of them.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I don't know. I feel like both of them, are starting to not reach what their potential is. And it's so crazy to me, but that's definitely something that's happening. And I feel like maybe that would be good, for Calipari to get to go to a place that hasn't had quite the success and get back up at it because he could build it back very quickly.
Yes.
Joe, speaking of teams that have had success, but this year were kind of underwhelming, Gonzaga. We both picked Gonzaga to lose in the opening round to McNeese State, and now suddenly in this tournament they're looking more dominant than ever. I mean, they look like one of those one seed Gonzaga teams, and I keep wondering if them not having the pressure of being undefeated going into the tournament, of being a one seed, of being where, the king of the mid majors, and this year they were, just a good team, maybe means this is the year that it could be for them. Maybe they finally win a national championship when they don't have all that pressure on.
Yeah, it looks like they've really hit their stride at the perfect time. I mean, not many teams just go out there and beat Kansas like that. Maybe we could have a conversation about Bill Self as well. Of course, he won national title 2 years ago, but still, I mean, that was very impressive. Also, beating McNeese the way they did. Here's what I've noticed with this team. You've got some really talented players that kind of fell under the radar, like Ryan Nembhard, who transferred from Creighton, and Graham Ike, who transferred from Wyoming. Those are two of the best players in the country. And I think that the tide turned for this team when Mark Few just decided basically to roll the dice and play like just five or six players a game. and have no depth because their starting five is as good as anybody. It's just, they don't have a great bench. And I think that the reason they were slow out of the gate this year is they had a key injury to one of their other transfers. What's his name? Steele Venters. He was like a big transfer they had. And he got hurt like in the exhibition season. So he didn't get to play this year. And so I think it took them some time to figure out kind of like how to score without him. And now they figured it out. And like I said, as long as their depth doesn't catch up to them and these starters can play heavy minutes, I mean, this team's got a really good chance to knock off Purdue.
Yeah, I think they got a great chance to knock off Purdue. I mean, Purdue has looked excellent in their first two games, but you and I both just don't believe in them. We've seen them, fail in the tournament over and over again. And Matt Painter, I mean, as far as I know, still hasn't even made a Final Four yet.
No, he never has as close as that Elite Eight loss to Virginia.
And this Gonzaga team, they've been there so many times that this is going to be a really tough matchup for Purdue. Because I think the psychological edge has got to be with Gonzaga.
Yeah, I mean, the Purdue has like a huge disadvantage at the guard position. And yeah, they've got Edie, but I feel like, a lot of those guys for Gonzaga can kind of cause him some problems. I think you just got to kind of irritate him some.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and but when they play teams that have a lot of good guards, that's when they tend to lose. So I think Gonzaga definitely has the edge on that one. Joe, speaking of Kansas, who Gonzaga beat so soundly in the second round, we've talked about it before that there's like some calls sometimes that really protect Blue Bloods. And I gotta say that the worst call that we've seen so far in the tournament was in the first round when Bucky Ball, Bucky McMillan, and Samford came all the way back from 22 points to have a chance to beat Kansas. And they were down by 1 point. Kansas guy's going in for an easy layup, and the Samford guy makes an incredible block from behind that's obviously all ball, and they call a foul on him and give Kansas two free throws that essentially wins the game for Kansas. And I thought for the most part there wasn't a whole lot of bad officiating. I know the Auburn game had a lot of people upset about it with the ejection, and I think I saw that the Auburn official is the only ones who don't get to do any games this weekend. Like they X'd out that crew. But that was the worst individual call that I saw all weekend was the foul on Samford.
Yeah, that was a travesty. The way that played out, it changed the total complexity of that game. I admire how the Samford coach, kind of took the high road on that one. But yeah, that was very disappointing.
Yeah. Flipping on the other side though, in terms of from disappointing games and the way it ends to the most exciting games, I really thought that Creighton Oregon game was the best game that I've watched this entire tournament. I loved watching Oregon in a defeat with Nfali, their incredible player they have from Mali, and the story that he has, where basically all the NIL money that he's had, he's sent back to help build his family a house in Mali, which is a very impoverished country. I mean, I think if you look at their human development index, and there it's like a bottom seven country in the entire world. And the fact that he's sitting there at Oregon and doing what he does, an incredible story. So I was really cheering for Oregon, and I hated to see them lose. But on the flip side, Creighton is such a fascinating team to watch with just the way they can score. Kalkbrenner, great inside man, but can jack up threes from everywhere. And that was just a cool game because I thought Creighton showed why they're a team that we both picked to go to the Final Four by beating a really motivated and talented Oregon team.
Yeah, I've been very impressed with the coaching job that Greg McDermott's done this year because I talked about them losing Nembhard to Gonzaga. I mean, that was a big loss. He was their starting point guard for an Elite Eight team last year. And they come back this year, and you've seen Trey Alexander really emerge. He's got a lot of NBA talent. You have Shireman as another guard. You talk about Kalkbrenner. Those three guys, I think they're the only tandem of three players for any team in the country that averaged 17 points or more, all three of them. And so to me, that is a scary monster, three-headed monster that's going to make it really tough for Tennessee to defeat. Like, I feel like Tennessee's more of that one or two-man show.
Yeah, exactly. We'll talk about that in the next show, but that's going to be an exciting Sweet 16 matchup. And Joe, mentioning Tennessee, that was a great game they had against Texas, too. I thought that was one of the better games in the tournament. We all expected Tennessee to be there in the Sweet 16, but we never would have imagined that there'd be only one other team that made the Sweet 16 from the SEC. And that, in fact, with all these very talented teams, Auburn, Florida, Kentucky, South Carolina, the only teams that would have made it to the Sweet 16 would be Tennessee and Alabama. And that A&M would be the only other one to even get a loss. I mean, I almost feel like it's karma for Greg Sankey going out there and making a comment about how there should be less mid-majors in the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, that was kind of ironic that that happened. But I went back and looked, and I had the stat at one point. A lot of these SEC teams, had some questionable losses during the regular season. I talked about Kentucky with UNC Wilmington. Tennessee, lost to some of these other, power teams and other conferences that, were at the forefront of their conference. So I was a little bit concerned coming into the tournament about the SEC with some of these head-to-head matchups. And, it continued. I was telling you before the show, another game I really enjoyed watching was Florida Colorado. I give a lot of credit to Clayton Jr. for Florida. He's one of my favorite players to watch in the country. He scored 33 points, almost single-handedly won that game for Florida. But yet Colorado beat them in a great game with the last-second shot by KJ Simpson. And so it just kind of continued that theme of, all these SEC teams, with the exception of like two or three, being able to survive.
Yeah, I mean, A&M, I thought made quite an effort. They took Houston all the way to double overtime. I thought that was a really interesting game because Houston had fouled so many times on A&M that they had to put a walk-on into the game in double overtime, who, A&M was so locked down with Buzz Williams' great defense. The only person that was open was the walk-on, and he had to go there and make a free throw in order for Houston to win the game. And what I thought was like, one of the neatest moments in the tournament, it was right after Shedd had fouled out for Houston. And I think that those kind of games, in my mind, if you can win one of those as like a top seed, always makes you dangerous moving on. So I think that's going to be a real motivating factor for Houston moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, that was the litmus test for Houston. For them to be able to survive that and coming back the way they got embarrassed against Iowa State, that said a lot to me about that team.
Absolutely. I got to say a lot about Nate Oates right now. What he has done at Alabama, they've really, they answered the call. Like, he got hired right after, like, I think he got hired a week before Bruce Pearl made the Final Four. And since Nate Oates has been there, it's been back and forth between Auburn, Tennessee, and Alabama as the best programs in the SEC. And Nate Oates, this year, after having the number one overall seed last year that couldn't quite get over the San Diego State Hex, had a rough end of the season, lost five out of their last six games. But I know they haven't had the hardest draw, but they're sitting here in the Sweet 16. And in my mind, they are the most surprising team that's in the Sweet 16 right now.
The thing about Alabama is, we talk about teams like Gonzaga kind of having a free shot. Like Alabama, maybe as much as anybody, the free shot here, not really expected to be here at all. And I think that it helps them, not having that pressure. Even what was it, 3 years ago when they lost to UCLA, they were a two seed, with a great chance to make it to the Final Four. And so this is kind of a rare occasion in recent history for Nate Oates where just no pressure at all. And nobody really expects him to beat North Carolina, so it just kind of continues.
That's right. And speaking of no pressure, no pressure for y'all to listen to us and more. We'll be back on the other side. As always, I'm Dan.
And I'm Joe.